Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello there, thank you for downloading. This is the Redbox Politics podcast from The Times. I am not Matt Chorley, quite obviously. I'm Luke Jones. I'm sitting in all this week on his Times radio show, 10 till 1 during the week. And today we're going to be talking a bit about Metro Mayors, because it is a month away from the elections in May, when of course there are elections in Cardiff and Holyrood and in lots of English councils. But also it's the end of the first term for many of these new Metro Mayors, which were all brand spanking new in 2017, the likes of the Greater Manchester Mayor or the one in the Liverpool City region or Tees Valley. So we're going to ask, what has the Metro Mayors ever done for us? Have they been worth it? Have they actually been worth the time? And do we need more? Because this election cycle, there's going to be a brand new one. There's a West Yorkshire Mayor who'll be coming along. We'll talk about that in a minute with the Institute for Government and also Lord Heseltine. But first, our columnists for today, Finkelvich, Danny Finkelstein and David Aronovich. So let's first of all talk about all what was announced by Boris Johnson at Downing Street last night, cautiously but irreversibly raising a pint of beer as we latched on then. David, are you thrilled at the prospect?
I'm not thrilled at the prospect by that. I've never understood the Brits and their fixation on booze. I mean, the fact is there are all kinds of other things that you can go out and do, but nobody's kind of talking about it. It has to be a pint he has to raise. It's like kind of Farage always seen raising a pint in one hand, a fag in the other. It's a form of self-identification. Incidentally, a very male form of self-identification on the whole, I think. And I don't say that to be critical. I mean, guys have got to do something. As Lady Bracknell said, you know, I do like a man who has a hobby. But the booze thing, no, I'm one of that, probably a silent majority of British people don't like pubs, but I am, like everybody else, fixated on the question of what's opening, what's not, when we can do things, when we can't, whether the vaccine works, whether it doesn't, and so on. It is completely dominant in my thinking, even when I try to ignore it, and I do try very hard.
Danny, is it dominant in your thinking as well?
Yeah, it's so useless to me. They're opening tennis and pubs rather than Chinese restaurants and museums of political memorabilia.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, this whole thing about when I was working for William Hague, we did a focus group and asked people, you know, if you met William Hague in a pub, what would he be drinking? And I think they said he would sit in a corner by himself with a jacket on, with his jacket on, drinking sherry.
And that sounds lovely.
I think he took this literally, and I think that's one of the reasons we ended up with that 14 pints story.
Yes.
When he got asked about it, he didn't expect someone to add up the pints, but I think he was saying he drank beer rather than sherry. Whereas, you know, one of the reasons I can't be the leader of a political party, it's one in quite a long list, is that I don't drink. I only drink Diet Coke. So if I went into the working men's club in Sedgefield, which of course now closed down anyway, but if I did, I would be asking for a Diet Coke at the bar, which would be a problem.
But did you feel, David, did you feel the optimism from the Prime Minister? He was at pains to say numerous times that, you know, there was nothing in the data that suggested we weren't going to hit the April and May English roadmap targets.
It, Yes, it looks as though the vaccination programmes is working as you would expect from the data about its effectiveness. It looks like the schools thing, which they worried might set us back, has not set us back, that the variance is not yet setting us back. So that is all good news. And so we're heading towards Chinese restaurants, definitely.
Yes.
It was definitely the case. I mean, the government made a huge series of errors last autumn in the run-up to Christmas, which was, we're all going to do this, it's all going to be great, we're all going to blah, 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 and all that kind of Boris Johnson nonsense. And it all came badly unstuck. The vaccine rollout has saved them in that respect and saved us too. But they did learn the lesson. And the lesson was you don't overpromise what you're going to do in the immediate future because things can change. Things could be worse. You have to see how they go. This is genuine. It's not some kind of rhetorical thing. You actually do have to see whether or not you have a great big uptick as a result of schools and so on, because there's still a series of kind of unknowns. And they have taken, and what they have done, therefore, is under-promised, probably, on the reopening side, etc. And of course, they've taken a political hit for that to a certain, well, not a political hit, only in terms of their own backbenchers, actually, in terms of the gloominess which is supposed to kind of surround this. But what is quite clear is that the majority of British people understand this as a kind of strategy and approach, and insofar as they understand it, they support it.
Because what could affect...
A very important point about backbenchers is they're a lot quieter now it's working. And that has always been my theory, which is you have to pay a lot of attention to party dissent. But the way of reducing party dissent is to pay careful attention to the motivation, but not necessarily to the advice that they're giving. If you'd taken their advice, the situation would have got worse and their dissent would have got worse. By ignoring their advice, the situation got better and their dissent became less important.
But
it's a very interesting lesson in how to deal with dissent.
But in terms of certificates or passports or whatever, it's cross-party dissent, isn't it? There's a big chunk of Tories, there's the Lib Dems, there's Labour, on this sort of question of liberty with the passports and the like.
I do think, I mean, look, of course having to have a certificate reduces your liberty, but not being able to go to an event is also a reduction in your liberty. So if, and I think it's a bigger reduction personally than being asked to have either a vaccination or, and this is crucial, or a test, allowing allowing universal access, therefore, to the passports, right? And that is really the only argument against it. David had a very good column on this and several months ago made this observation. I think he was right.
Yeah, you could in one way put this as dog in the manger versus discrimination. You know, if I can't do it, no one can, versus if I can do it and other people can't, it's not fair. The point I made back then and that Dan is referring to is you can't really do it in any substantial way until most people or almost all people have had either the opportunity to be vaccinated. In other words, it's not their fault that they can't do the thing that they would not be permitted to do, or that they can be tested so that we can be relatively certain that they're going to be safe and not going to add up to some kind of a hazard. If you can't do those things, then in that case... And I think publicans have made this point extremely well. The idea of essentially showing people the door before they even kind of get in, because they're not vaccinated with something they couldn't have, or they're not tested because they couldn't afford it, or for whatever reason, is really problematic. But if you can satisfy those conditions, then you can do it. The other thing to say is there are certain things that we don't have control over, under which we will almost certainly have some form of vaccine passport anyway. And the most obvious one of that is for entry to other countries who will demand it. The first people to say they wanted vaccine passports, if you remember, it was the day actually our column came out, I was really annoyed about it because they announced it after the column was published, was Saga, when they said that they would only take people on their cruises with vaccine passports starting, I think, in May. And there's nothing very much the government could do about that.
And I keep banging on about this, but there's more reporting in the Times today about talking about holidays, that thousands of people, more than 5,000 Britons, visited the Maldives at the height of this most recent lockdown. And also Matt Dathan was reporting in the paper the other day that Border Force was saying that thousands of tourists are entering the UK every day despite ongoing lockdown restrictions, including one from Peru who stated on their visa that their reason for their trip was to visit Big Ben. I can't get my head around it. Danny, move us on to something else which you both want to talk about, which is what's described in the paper as a decade of disgrace at the honours system. The Queen is stripping honours from an increasing number of recipients in a process that critics say is shrouded in secrecy. Danny, what's happening with it?
Yeah, well, it's hard to read the story without thinking, obviously, a procedure of justice of any kind shouldn't be secret. Mm. Obviously, people should be. It should, if people receive these honours publicly, if they're removed, it should be public. That completely clear position jostles with my instinctive dislike of any kind of mob justice. My instinctive dislike, effectively, of public executions. I don't particularly wish to be present at someone else's humiliation, even if their humiliation is merited. It doesn't. It's not something that I have a great taste for. So these things kind of do jostle. Clearly, it seemed to me there's a fairly easy way of resolving this, which is that the fact that someone's gone into the process of being considered should be made public, and the fact that they come out of it should be made public as well. That does seem to be... But I can't view this with great relish, to be honest.
Because it'd be quite a moment, David, if every so often there's a list published being like, here's who's had their titles taken off them this month.
Well, exactly. I mean, of course, you and I don't have titles.
Not yet.
Whereas Danny does.
Yes.
I think it's getting a bit late for me, frankly, unless Danny puts in a word or unless I do something particularly bad. One of the things I feel about this, and I'm looking at it, is just how strange our honours system is. I imagine all honours systems are odd. But if you honour somebody because they do something really good, does them doing something bad mean that they shouldn't be honoured for the good thing that they did? In other words, at what point are they, and this literally is the word, cancelled?
Yes.
At what point does one actually cancel the other out? And then there's the question, on what basis do people get honours anyway? And the answer is, it's ridiculously arbitrary. And actually, the removal of honours in this case seems to be pretty arbitrary.
Well, I know we say this... Danny.
Go on, Dan.
Yeah, it is completely. You're completely correct. It's completely arbitrary. And I used to always point out after I got the OBE in John Major's resignation honours list that I had an OBE that Ringo Starr didn't have, and how preposterous that was. now, fortunately, he's got a knighthood. Of course, the reason why people can have it removed is that you become an officer in an order. So it's actually an office. I mean, rather than simply a medal. And that's it's an idiosyncrasy of the honours system that allows that to happen. It's, of course, a broader historical question, interestingly, about Churchill, for example. Does, which we're having all the time, does his racism cancel out his leadership of Britain in the Second World War? That is, those are very live questions. Does one thing cancel out another? While we have a system as we have it in some way, there's going to be the question of whether or not people are allowed to continue. And I don't think it's too bad to have a system where people can have the honour removed. I just don't think a social system where we all publicly relish it is very good for the public morale. But maybe other people differ. Every people's tastes in these things differ. Some people may enjoy that or think it's valuable for honour.
But also going down the list of some of the examples given in the paper, they were kind of being publicly vilified anyway. Sort of Robert Mugabe losing his honorary Knight Grand Cross of the Order of Bath, Chris Hume not becoming a Privy Council anymore, Rolf Harris dispensing with his CBE. Yeah. It's sort of, they're already in the market for being vilified, aren't they?
I mean, hold on, Daddy. Before you do, just think about that for a moment. This has managed to bracket Chris Hume's driving offence with Robert Mugabe. and this just begins to show you. I mean, the thing.
Well, no, in fairness, Danny, there's Fred Goodwin in between them in the list.
Yeah, Fred Goodwin in between. And the thing that Danny said about them being kind of members of something, I didn't even know that. I'm 66 and I didn't know that. And it's obviously of no importance whatsoever. And they obviously don't do anything with it other than kind of, flout the gong around and stick it on the end of their letterheads, etc., where they're so minded. Or if you're Simon Jenkins, you tell everybody that you don't want to be called Sir, which I think is the best one of all.
Really. I agree with that.
And I mean, we always say there should be an overhaul of honours and the basis on which they should be given. And then we realise we'd never agree about what should be in that overhaul. As a result of not being able to agree, we continue with the absurd system we've already got.
Of course. And what is an objective?
To ourselves, it's absurd.
What is an objective system? I agree with that. Interestingly, you said Fred Goodwin was in the list. He stuck out for me because, in fact, he's the one person on the list who had their honour removed for not committing a crime.
So he's former.
I thought that was very interesting, and I was actually against that, and I didn't think that I think he probably shouldn't have had that knighthood awarded in the first place because it was kind of awarded for services to financial laxity. But having given it to him, I didn't think that was right, actually. Whereas the other ones, I did think was right. But when I wrote that, which I did, it was one of my more lonely columns.
Yes. David, tell us about the political drama in the US. We're slightly light on political drama in Congress at the moment since Donald Trump left. This is Matt Gaetz.
I've just been following this in a kind of small way, that's not even true. I'm listening to everything I possibly can listen to about this because it's so bizarre. Matt Gaetz is this Florida congressman who is incredibly pro-Trump. He actually looks, if you look at him, he looks as if he's actually being put together by computer. He's got this kind of extraordinary hair and face, etc. So he actually looks as if he's somebody's avatar, etc. And he's, sort of the biggest kind of pro-Trump person there is. And he has gradually been embroiled in a scandal which involves one of the other office holders in Florida, something like the tax assessor. Danny, you probably understand the positions better than I do in Florida. And what this other guy has done, who Gaetz was a friend of, and that Gaetz might have known about, is a catalogue of things that are so bizarre that you can get away with, or that he has up until now get away with in the States. But in the end, it's led up to Gaetz being accused of trafficking a minor across, for sexual reasons, across state lines. In this case, the girl, the alleged person, is 17, so wouldn't count in Britain, but does count in America. At which point he then kind of counterattacks in the traditional kind of what you call the Roy Cohn way, which is by attacking those who are accusing him by saying it's absolutely kind of appalling how he's being accused. And the whole thing is just, it's a Netflix series happening right out there. I do recommend people kind of go into and sort of check it up on Google.
The details are fantastic. Including his fiance.
It's not quite the Jeremy Thorpe scandal.
No.
But it's not far off that in terms of its kind of eye-boggling nature, isn't it?
And I just wanted to mention, in terms of the maybe a screen adaptation, which either of you might turn your pen to, the details. So his fiance, who's standing by him, is called Ginger Lucky, and they met at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort.
Yeah, it is incredible.
And it involves this stuff about sugar daddies, which is the most appalling kind of setup, really, in which kind of younger women hook up with older men in return for money. It's a kind of form of sort of fool yourself prostitution.
But Danny, yesterday we were talking with Rachel Sylvester and Libby Purves about the decline of shame in public life, and this seems like another example of that, doesn't it? Across the pond.
Well, it does. It's interesting because it does link to the point actually we were discussing with Honours and what role public pillaring is and has and all that. My view is that we have sort of declined in the extent to which we care about people's sexual peccadilloes, they often don't produce scandals. But this was a combination of unbelievable hypocrisy with probably outright abuse and possibly law breaking as well. It's interesting that somebody who clearly thought his politics were above the law quite possibly thought other parts of his behaviour were above the law as well. And how somebody can be plausible in the way that Matt Gaetz is while saying things that are incredibly implausible.
You're listening to the Times Redbox Politics Podcast. I'm Luke Jones, in for Matt Chorley. That was David Aronovich and Danny Finkelstein, columnist, taking us through the news. Now, though, it's time to talk mayors. What have they ever done for us?
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, it is a month away from the May elections, and it's the end of the first full term for a load of metro mayors in England. They were shiny and new in 2017, metro mayors for Cambridgeshire and Peterborough, Greater Manchester, the Liverpool City region, Tees Valley, the West of England and the West Midlands. But what have metro mayors ever done for us? Akash Pawn is a senior fellow for the Institute of Government, live with us. Hi, Akash.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you very much for your time. First of all, rewind us back to, well, pre-2017 and the logic of having these mayors in the first place and in those places.
Yeah, sure. So, metro mayors were put in place in, we've got them in eight or nine city regions across England, to fill the gap, really, at the intermediate level between central government and local councils, which has existed ever since the Conservative government back in the 1980s abolished bodies that existed like the GLC in London and metropolitan counties in other big English cities. So ever since then, we've lacked that kind of middle tier of governance. The Labour government tried to fill it with regional development agencies and regional assemblies and so on, and that didn't really take root. But the government, certainly after 2015, recognised that there was a need for elected institutions at that level to take decisions around transport, around house building, around provision of certain public services that really operate at a regional level and are too large for individual local councils to be responsible for.
And you're using words there like decisions and responsible for, but I wonder actually how much power that they actually have.
Well, the picture is quite mixed. I mean, we've seen the development of in some ways quite different models in different parts of the country. So, I think when you look at the metro mayors that are in post today, it's clear that, for example, Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester has a wider set of responsibilities than some of his counterparts. So he, for instance, and the same will apply to the new mayor to be elected in West Yorkshire as well, plays the role of police and crime commissioner. So some of the mayors have a role in justice policy in that way. All the mayors and the combined authorities that they chair do take decisions around transport policy, around investment into roads and rail, franchising of buses, for example. So public transport is a big area of responsibility for them. They also have power over skills provision, so commissioning of education for adults. Particularly education, not higher education, not universities, but education that's linked to getting people ready for work or getting people back into work. So those are some of the big areas. And then they have a role also in spatial planning, in deciding where new houses should be built, though the mayors can only really build houses when they can agree to get the money from central government and when they can agree with local councils on exactly where to put them.
And across, I know it will vary across all the different metro mayors that we mentioned from 2017, but on the whole, would you say it's worked? Would you say, as providing that middle layer, would you say, having an elected official who can take those kind of decisions, which you just listed off then, has it been fruitful?
You know, I do think it's quite early to make a really solid assessment of the impact of this set of reforms, for the reason that the primary driver of this agenda was really an economic one. It was a recognition that, you know, in some of these big cities, so Greater Manchester, Birmingham, the West Midlands area, Liverpool and so on, economic productivity was lagging compared to London and the Southeast. And there needed to be these mayors and combined authorities to in place to develop a better strategy for economic growth and infrastructure investment and so on. And those are naturally things that take some time to pay off. So when you're talking about, you know, building new public transport systems, investing in skills and building new houses and infrastructure and so on, you can't really see the fruits of that in terms of improved economic performance for some time. But I do think that the mayors, well, in the end, it'll be for the voters to decide in the various places whether they're impressed or not by the performance of these new institutions. But I think that the mayors have shown their value in being able to develop joined up plans and strategies in partnership with councils and other local stakeholders. And as I say, being able to fill that gap between Whitehall and the town hall. The other way that I think you can really see that the impact that the mayors have made is the profile they've been able to give to their cities and regions, for example, in negotiations with central government to get more funding, or negotiations around coronavirus policy and lockdown restrictions and so on.
But that's an interesting point you raised, but did that actually work? There was lots of high-profile statements by the Greater Manchester Mayor and the West Midlands Mayor, and even in Tees Valley as well, but did they actually get anything out of it in the end in terms of pandemic relief?
Well, I think that is what that episode showed us, that on that particular issue, most of the levers were certainly held at the centre. And yes, I mean, Andy Burnham, obviously, in particular, and some of the other mayors as well, as you say, were very vocal in making the case for additional funding or changes to lockdown rules. But they didn't necessarily have the powers to change policy themselves. And I think that also goes to the point that this is very much an unfinished agenda. I mean, when it was kicked off after 2015, there was a lot of quite radical rhetoric around this being a devolution revolution. That was the phrase that George Osborne, who then was the sort of principal political driver of this, liked to use. And I don't think we've quite seen a revolution. The powers of the Metro Mayors is far short of the powers enjoyed, certainly by the devolved institutions in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. Mm. So I think there is a long way to go. But I think one would not want to turn back the clock, because the basic rationale for putting in mayors and the combined authorities as well at that tier of government is still very much valid.
And just finally, Akash, in terms of your years watching what's been happening, which one's been your favourite?
Which of the mayors?
Yeah, as in not the personality, but the place and the position and maybe what's been done with it.
Well, I mean,
or
I don't
the
really
most
want
interesting
to, sort of league table ranking. I mean, as I say, I mean, the model in Greater Manchester is the most extensive. I mean, that's partly because it was building on institutions that existed long before 2017, indeed before 2015. There was a long history of collaboration between local authorities in that area, so they have been able to go further, and I think that's given the mayor there the ability to join up across different public services and these different economic functions in a way that is beyond what is available to some of the other mayors. So I think Greater Manchester does have some lessons that other places can learn from as this process continues to progress.
Akash Bourne, Senior Fellow at the Institute of Government, thank you very much for briefing us on that. And as Akash mentioned, there's going to be a new Metro Mayor added to this list in West Yorkshire. The race is well underway. Rob Parsons is the political editor at the Yorkshire Post, live with us this morning. Hi, Rob.
Morning.
So tell us about the race so far. Who are the runners and riders?
Yes, so there are seven candidates who've currently declared themselves, and it's the kind of mixture you might expect. There are a few local councillors as well as representatives of smaller, more local parties. I think it's fair to say that for people outside West Yorkshire, there probably aren't any real household names in the running. In the last few months, there was talk of the likes of Justine Greening or maybe Saeeda Varsi, who are both from Yorkshire, running for the Conservatives, or any of the well-known Labour MPs like Yvette Cooper, but that didn't materialise in the end. So the two main contenders are Tracy Brabin for Labour and Matt Robinson.
Name. Tracy Brabin's a household name.
That's true. Perhaps I'm doing Tracy a disservice. But
depends how political your household is, I guess.
That is true. Yeah. I think she possibly doesn't have quite the name recognition because she hasn't been an MP for quite as long as some of the others that I've mentioned. But she is an interesting one, actually. She became MP for Batley and Spen after the murder of Joe Cox in 2016. But her background is in culture and the arts, and she's a former actress in Coronation Street, amongst other things. And she served as shadow culture minister under Jeremy Corbyn and Keir Starmer. So I think if she became mayor, she would she'd have quite a heavy focus on culture, I think, because that is one of her big areas of interest. Matt Robinson, who's the Conservative, he's a Tory councillor in North Leeds, and he's got a senior shadow role on the Labour-run Leeds City Council, and he's previously stood to run as the local police and crime commissioner. The bookmakers have got Tracy as a odds-on favourite to win, and I think that's fair. She's got a bit more name recognition, despite what I said earlier, and despite the 2019 general election results, West Yorkshire, I think, still generally is more inclined to vote Labour. There could be a low turnout, I suppose, which might make for a more unpredictable result. But as there are local elections going on throughout West Yorkshire at the same time, I think that will boost the turnout potentially. It's quite interesting, I think, that Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, has come to West Yorkshire to support Tracy Brabin. But so far, I haven't seen a huge amount of evidence of the Tory party machine throwing its weight behind their candidate, which I guess might be sort of give an indication of how hopeful they are about winning. And there are, in terms of other candidates, there are local councillors standing as the Liberal Democrat and Green Party hopefuls. There's a candidate from the Yorkshire Party, which wants to see Yorkshire have its own parliament, and the Reform UK and the English Democrats also have candidates. But I think, to be honest, unless there's a big surprise, it will almost certainly come down to either Tracy Brabin or Matt Robinson as the winner.
And tell us about the position itself, because whoever wins will become the mayor of West Yorkshire. What powers exactly will they have? What will the role be?
Well, I mean, it's similar to other mayors around the country, though obviously devolution deals do vary a bit. I think one of the interesting sort of quirks in West Yorkshire is that whoever is mayor will take on the powers of the police and crime commissioner, which not many mayors have chosen to do so far. And actually, Tracy Brabin has yet to reveal who her deputy would be, if her policing deputy would be. I think if you look in Greater Manchester or London, which are mayors who have taken on that policing power, it's policing is one of those issues which can end up sort of generating some sort of negative press for the mayor. So it might potentially be a millstone around their neck, or might give them an opportunity to, you know, shape the agenda. But I think amongst local leaders and businesses in West Yorkshire, there's quite a strong appetite for a Metro mayor and the devolved powers and funding they bring with them. They recognise how vital this could be in rejuvenating the West Yorkshire economy, particularly as we come out of the pandemic. Transport links are notoriously poor in this part of the world. In fact, it's the largest urban area in Western Europe without a rapid mass transit system. And the devolution deal that created this post of Metro Mayor will make it easier for West Yorkshire to bid into a £4 billion funding pot to help build a metro system. And adult skills is a big one too. It's I think it will only become more so as the economy changes post-pandemic, because productivity levels in West Yorkshire, as Akash alluded to, are below the national average. And I think it comes down to a lack of skilled jobs, which is kind of linked to the relatively poor educational outcomes. So whoever's elected Metro Mayor will get control of the £63 million a year adult education budget, so they can help tailor the kind of courses that are available to people after they leave school, with the aim of matching them up with what employers are looking for.
And Rob, it's hard, I guess, to gauge a month out from the actual election, but how can we sense how engaged people who are eligible to vote actually are in this?
Well, like you say, it is difficult to tell. And I guess I think that the campaign has been a bit of a slow burn so far, because obviously we're still in a form of lockdown. It's harder to do campaigning, and the candidates can't get out and about as much. I would say, like I said before, it helps that there are local elections going on at the same time, so people would be voting for their local councillors anyway. But I think it's probably fair to say that amongst the general public, awareness of metro mayors and what they do is probably relatively low, because their roles are a bit hard to define, not quite as easy to understand as a councillor or a council leader. And I think for some people, they might not make the distinction between these metro mayors, who have a sort of economic role across a wider city region, and the elected local mayors that you might remember there was a referendum on in 2012, and most people in Yorkshire rejected that idea. So I think there may be for some people a bit of confusion about what this metro mayor will actually do.
Thank you very much for your time this morning, for briefing us on what's ahead potentially for the Mayor of West Yorkshire, Rob Parsons, political editor at the Yorkshire Post. Stay tuned, we'll hear from somebody who's a big fan of devolution, Lord Heseltine.
This is Times Radio.
Live with us this morning to talk metro mayors and what on earth they've ever done for us is former Deputy Prime Minister Lord Heseltine. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
So in terms of, we've had almost a first full term from the metro mayors for, as I mentioned earlier, Greater Manchester, Liverpool, City Region, Tees Valley, West of England, West Midlands, Cambridge and Peterborough. Has it been worth it, do you think?
Well, I think it's an essential step to the proper management of our economy. It's an essential step to replicate what every other advanced economy of our sort in the world does, which is to devolve power to local leaders, local effective machinery, and to people who understand, because they live and breathe and work there, the powers to make things happen. Frankly, this is a journey which began in the 1960s, when I first became involved, when the Redcliffe-Maud report looked at the structure of local government in this country. There were then 1,400 local authorities. We got it down to about 300 now. But actually, the recommendation then was we needed 60 unitary authorities. As I say, we've still got 300. There's too many, there's too much overlapping, there's too much blurring of the responsibilities, and there is much, much too much power concentrated in London. And worse, it's not even concentrated coherently, it's concentrated functionally. We've got a Ministry of Housing, a Ministry of Transport, a Ministry of this, a Ministry of that, and the relationship and the coordination is simply unsuited to driving the local economies, which are the vital ingredients of the national economy.
You talk about this as being a journey. For you, in an ideal world, what is the end point?
Well, the end point
as in an ideal
unitary authorities, about 60 of them. Yes, well, the ideal thing would be for the government to introduce legislation to designate about 60 authorities. There would be the major conurbation authorities. We've made a lot of progress there. And then there would be unitary counties. They would all have significantly enhanced powers over their industrial strategy. They would all have elected mayors so that there was somebody accountable, somebody identifiable, and someone with the ability, frankly, to nod and coordinate local enthusiasms. That's the ideal. And it looked as though we were going to get very close to that. Certainly George Osborne as Chancellor and Greg Clark as the appropriate Secretary of State, very considerable strides were made a few years ago. The truth is that the momentum of it, the devolution agenda, is dead. And if you look at the work that the government is doing, it's all now back to functional announcements, a bit of transport here, a bit of housing, all on the implementation of the Grand Whitehall. It's a step, and it's a huge missed opportunity. Frankly, COVID has drawn a curtain all of this, and that we can all understand and sympathize with. But the Brexit challenge, the restructuring that is consequent on Brexit, That has been set back by the failure to pursue the devolution agenda.
And so I wonder how you square what you're saying as the devolution agenda being dead within this current government and their aspirations for some kind of a levelling up between North and South England in particular.
Well, what they've done is to promise that the mayoral authorities would all get the same powers as Manchester, but they've not done anything about it. So you've got this patchwork quilt of conurbation authorities with a range of different powers. And then, to make it worse, when George Osborne was there, there was a central government pot of expenditure to which the mayors could bid for capital expenditure over a reasonable period of time. That's now all been broken up effectively into the budgets of the spending departments. And the way this was going to be dealt with was a white paper on devolution. Hmm. And, well, you're a journalist, there are lots of other journalists around. You start making inquiries about what is going on in Whitehall about the devolution agenda, and you'll get a lot of evasive replies. I tried the other day, I put down a parliamentary question, and the reply, frankly, was an insult. I would never have allowed a reply like that to get past me as a minister to a parliamentary question. It would simply sort of, you know, shrug your shoulders, now you see, now you don't. So it's quite obvious that the enthusiasm that George Osborne and Greg Clark deployed, which really made progress, has been turned off.
Of course, famously, quite recently, Boris Johnson was caught saying that Scottish devolution had been a disaster. Do you think he feels the same about England?
I've no idea. He was mayor of London, rather good mayor of London. And so I can't believe he thinks that. But you've got to allow, Boris does say sometimes, which are perhaps not as well considered in context. Hmm. So I'm not going to get drawn on that aspect.
Could I just finally ask you a couple of questions on different things, if I may? We've been hearing a lot in the Sunday Times and on Times Radio about your colleagues, the hereditary peers, how they are overwhelmingly white and male, how they're expensive, how they barely say anything in the chamber, and how they're more often than not talking about their own business interests. You in the past, about 20 years ago, voted against getting rid of them. Has your opinion changed?
I think the House of Lords is difficult to justify until you try to create something else. And when you try to create something else, effectively, you end up with a second House of Commons. And I don't think that that has a lesson which encourages the trauma of change. Of course, headlines are headlines, and anything that goes wrong is quite understandably profiled. But the House of Lords is full of some very intelligent and industrious people. It makes a major contribution.
Even in terms of the hereditary peers.
Unsung. I mean, whether, you know, you've got the bishops, for example, is another interesting example of what you want to have as a reflection of this country today. So you can look at all sorts of aspects of it and say, well, let's tinker here, let's adjust there. But in the end, you're left with an anachronism for the past and an agreement as to what to do in its place. Mm. So, frankly, there are many more urgent things to deal with than this changing the House of Lords.
And just very finally, we're talking about politicians and drinks today. I wonder, who is the best politician in your career that you've had a drink with? Who was the best boozer and what did they have?
Well, I think the drink is totally irrelevant. To me, the Prime Minister that I regard as outstanding of my lifetime is Harold Macmillan, because he told the truth about Britain's changed position in the world. And it's a very, very difficult thing to tell a nation that they've got to change their assumptions.
That's all we've got time for on the Red Box Politics podcast. Thank you very much for downloading. Do subscribe wherever you found us, by the way. It means that this podcast plops into your phone or device or whatever every time there's a new one. And remember, if you want to get the Redbox email every morning, which Patrick Maguire runs, which is excellent, you have to become a Times subscriber. So go to the Times website, you can get your first month free, and you not only get the Redbox email, but you get the business briefing as well, which is really good. They're all online, times.co.uk/subscribe. And if you're a bit old-fashioned and like linear live broadcasting, I'm sitting in for Matt. His radio show on Times Radio is live 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday to Thursday, and you can get Times Radio on DAB, the app, or you can listen on your smart speaker if you're one of those funky people who've got one of those. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.